Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
Reaction continues over the announcement that Sumitomo Rubber in Tonawanda will be closing, putting 1,500 employees out of work. The facility falls in the 140th Assembly District, represented by Bill Conrad, who says just 2 years ago, the facility celebrated a $129 million upgrade.
It doesn't make sense to me. It's made money. The company's got a great profit margin, and you know, they made a calculated decision in Japan, and it's affecting us here.
Western New York Labor Federation AFL-CIO President Peter DeHuis Jr. called the decision, quote, a brutal betrayal of these workers and their families. One of the oldest bars in Buffalo is now closed following the death of its owner. The Swanee House on Ohio Street closed following the death of owner Tim Wiles. In an email to WBFO, Wiles' daughter, Maria Wiles Bell, said she and her brother are both living out of town and that trying to keep the establishment open would, quote, be a disservice to our dad's legacy. She expressed hope a new buyer may emerge to take over the landmark tavern. 28 people are recovering from injuries suffered in a bus crash of a tour bus outside Rochester on Thursday. The incident occurred on the 490 eastbound heading into Rochester. The driver, who was ejected through the front windshield, was ticketed for fatigue driving, speeding, unsafe lane change, and driving without a seatbelt. Buffalo acting mayor Chris Scanlon is mourning the death of his brother, who died Wednesday in an apparent hunting accident. In a statement, the acting mayor described his 54-year-old brother, Mark Scanlon, as a sergeant in the Erie County Sheriff's Department and a, quote, cherished husband, father, grandfather, son, brother, uncle, and friend who was loved by those who knew him. The Buffalo News reports Mark Scanlon may have died from a fall from a tree stand while hunting in the town of Otto. He was found by police who were called to provide a welfare check after Mark Scanlon did not return to his vehicle. New York State Attorney General Letitia James says her office is responding to reports of racist text messages targeting black and brown people, including students. James says New Yorkers and people across the country in recent days have been receiving the text messages that say they have, quote, been chosen to be a slave and, quote, selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation. Students in middle school, high school, and college have been among the recipients. James encourages anyone receiving the text to contact the Civil Rights Bureau at 800-771-7755. And four Erie County structures are among the nominees for the New York State and National Historic Registers of Historic Places. Included in the list of 24 properties statewide to earn the distinction are the Alden St. Bake Building, Yeoman's House in East Aurora, the Spencer Kellogg and Sons Elevator, and Sattler Theater, both in Buffalo. The new additions will be eligible for historic preservation programs and incentives. The Green Party was not available on this year's ballot due to current New York State election law. WBFO's Jamal Harris spoke with the secretary for the Erie County Green Party about their future in state politics.
Talks of the Green Party and its presidential candidate, Jill Stein, are always increased every presidential election cycle. However, things were different in New York State this time around for the Green Party due to a budget provision in 2020 that increased the threshold for automatic party ballot access to 2% or 130,000 votes, whichever is higher in presidential and gubernatorial elections. The Green Party did not reach those thresholds in the last election, only gaining less than 1% of the votes, and their automatic ballot access was removed. In an attempt to regain ballot access for this election, the Stein campaign spent $300,000 in an attempt to reach the necessary 45,000 valid signatures to petition to get on the ballot. That's also up 15,000 prior to 2020. These were all changes made under the former governor's administration, Andrew Cuomo. However, Secretary for the Green Party of Erie County, Sandy Prisbylak, is not hopeful that things would change under Governor Hochul.
I am not hopeful that the Democrats are in any kind of position or will advocate for minor party lines to have ballot access similar to the old rules where we only had to get 50,000 votes for governor every 4 years to maintain it.
Due to these current restrictions, high-profile offices such as President of the United States or Governor of New York are likely out of reach, but down-ballot races, especially downstate in New York City, could be within reach. Prisbylak tells WBFO why they're hopeful they could achieve progress down there.
I think New York City, some of the boroughs in New York City, Queens, Brooklyn, and the Bronx have people that are interested in running there. And I think they have a real shot of winning. I think AOC and the squad are going to have some credibility issues now with what just happened.
Votes are still being tallied, but the Green Party received just a bit over 643,000 votes nationally. That's good enough for 0.4%. I'm Jamal Harris, WBFO.
The Indigenous Studies Department at the University of Buffalo is continuing to put research at its forefront. The department, which recently implemented a bachelor's degree program, relaunched its Haudenosaunee Research Symposium to present the work done by its professors. WBFO's Ryan Zunner has the story during Native American Heritage Month.
The symposium offered the chance for the UB community and public to not only take in that information, but to engage and understand with the Haudenosaunee academics themselves.
The one thing that all of our faculty hold dear is making our research matter to communities. And I think it's that heart in making it matter and having those different methodologies for approaching some of the problems that are in our community or wanting to understand the past, the present, and also where we're going in the future. That really is at the heart.
Presentations covered a wide range of topics, including language, data sovereignty, the environment, Haudenosaunee women leadership, and health in Indigenous communities. Some of that work examines past research done on Native people, but by non-Native academics, which Dr. Meredith Alberta Palmer, Six Nations Tuscarora, says is rooted in colonialism, particularly the work of Dr. James V. Neal.
He did a lot of research on what he hypothesized was the thrifty gene theory, which was his idea that Native American people get diabetes more commonly because we are genetically predisposed to the disease. He came up with this theory first in 1962, and he got funding to research it. But since then, it's actually never been borne out in any genetic research that the thrifty gene theory actually exists in the world.
Alberta Palmer says Neal's first focused his research on Native tribes across the United States, but according to letters from the mid-1960s to colleagues, they had to be, quote, dirty Indians to satisfy the needs of his research. He categorized Native people he was looking into researching as, quote, wild Indian and tame Indian. After first visiting Navajo, Seminole, and Acamel Owadom territories and taking blood samples, Alberta Palmer says Neal's expressed frustration in his thrifty gene research. He blamed it on the three tribes not being truly indigenous under his genetic criteria.
There's no other sovereign nations where your genetic identity determines whether you have citizenship and membership. It is about being claimed by that community, not by whether or not your genes match. Yet, however, this was his criteria. And so in order to find what he deemed pure or wild primitive people, he traveled down to Brazil and extracted blood and froze it and flew it back from a group called the Yanomami people.
Neal's use of the Brazilian Yanomami in his thrifty gene theory is something U.S. medical circles still promote. Alberta Palmer argues this assumption leads to inadequate action in helping her people and other tribes in addressing health disparities like diabetes, obesity, and heart disease.
The fact is that so much more research continues to go into the genetic basis for this kind of these kinds of illnesses, especially metabolic illnesses in our communities, when it's really actually systemic change that needs to happen.
Systemic change is something Haudenosaunee women know quite well. Clan mothers play an important role in the continuation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, a form of government that dates back long before Europeans stepped foot in North America. Male chiefs didn't receive their position without the consensus and support from these influential women, and that traditional form of government continues to exist today, even with other political entities. Leadership from women in Haudenosaunee communities still plays a vital role, even outside the bounds of traditional government. That's the area Associate Professor Teresa McCarthy, Six Nations Onondaga, explored in her research, which put an emphasis on the role women played in the Caledonia land dispute in Ontario, which turned into direct action starting in 2006.
It was the first time in our 250-year history at Grand River that we've regained rather than lost our lands because of those actions.
McCarthy is working on putting a book together to serve as an archive of the leadership displayed by Haudenosaunee women during that extended dispute. The Indigenous Studies Department hopes to restart the research symposium as an annual event to showcase the work its professors and students are doing to elevate Haudenosaunee culture and history in a higher education setting. Ryan Zunner, WBFO News.
The Sabres have dominated their last two opponents. The NCAA has made an impactful rule change. Two top teams in Western New York meet in the semifinals tonight on Friday Night Lights, and two high school football records were smashed last night. I'm Jack Cruiser. This is The Scoreboard for Friday, November 8th. This episode of The Scoreboard has been edited for length. The full version is available at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Sabres fans might have to accept the reality that their team is extremely streaky this season, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Following their second three-game losing skid this year, Buffalo responded with resounding blowout victories over the Ottawa Senators and the New York Rangers. Tuesday's 5-1 victory over Ottawa was hard-fought, with over 70 hits delivered by the two teams combined throughout the night. On Thursday, it was an all-out attack by the Blue and Gold from the first face-off to the final whistle, earning a 6-1 win over the Rangers at Madison Square Garden. There were three constants in both Buffalo wins this week. The first, timely goaltending. The second, depth scoring. And the third, the special teams production. The fact of the matter is, Buffalo might be a streaky team this season. While a hot and cold team for the entire season is not what Coach Lindy Ruff or their staff would like, it's at least enjoyable for the fans. Given their ability to look as dominant as they have against some really good teams so far, no matter what their record is come January, you shouldn't count them out of making a run to the playoffs. Buffalo hosts Calgary for a non-league game on Saturday at 1 p.m. Just yesterday, the NCAA Division I Council approved a rule allowing players with Canadian Hockey League experience to compete at U.S. colleges starting next season. This ruling negates a ban that kept CHL players from coming across the border to play for American universities due to the $600 a month stipend that players receive from their CHL teams. In the last decade, the NCAA has completely shifted from heavily restricting student-athletes to now building infrastructure supporting the payment of players. Years after football and basketball players got their way, this move was long overdue, and now opens up a pool of talent for U.S. college hockey programs to recruit. To dive deeper, I spoke with Niagara University head coach Jason Lammers about this decision to hear his thoughts on how this ruling may affect the Purple Eagles on how they look to attack recruiting moving forward.
It won't change much for us because our entire intent is to find uncommon people. I think it's too fresh. I think it's too new. And I think there will be good things, unintended positive consequences out of this and unintended negative consequences from this.
My full conversation with Coach Lammers is available on our website at WBFO.org. Tonight on Friday Night Lights, it's the most highly anticipated game of the year as the Clarence Red Devils take on the Sweet Home Panthers in the Section 6 Class A semifinal. With a trip to Highmark Stadium and the championship game on the line, this game is so much more than just two of the best quarterbacks in Western New York going head-to-head. Clarence is the defending champion with a host of returners on both sides of the ball, led by senior quarterback Bryce Toubin, who is one of the most mentally advanced players in the area, regardless of position. His ability to dissect a defense and consistently make the right decisions is Tom Brady-esque, and he's got the championship demeanor to match. The Panthers lost in the semifinal last year and return almost all of the key pieces that suffered that loss. Third-year starting quarterback Rocco Panapinto is playing the best football of his career right now. His awareness in the pocket and ability to improvise and create when a play breaks down is Patrick Mahomes-esque, and he's got the moxie to match. Catch the game tonight on Friday Night Lights on WBFO and WNED Create at 7 p.m. Justice Kleitz ended his junior season at Iroquois High School by setting multiple Western New York records. While the Redhawks missed the playoffs this year, Kleitz set a new record for passing yards in a career with 6,897 yards thrown. The previous record was set last season by South Park's Noah Willoughby. The difference here is that Justice Kleitz is only a junior. His top target at receiver, Nick Skutnik, set the Western New York single-season records for both receptions and receiving yards. This has been The Scoreboard for Friday, November 8th. I'm Jack Cruiser for WBFO Sports.
For Theater Talk on WBFO, I'm Anthony Chase.
And I'm Peter Hall.
And the busiest week of theater so far this season, you and I got up to the Jewish Repertory Theater of Western New York to see Remember This, The Lesson of Jan Karski, starring David Lundy.
Well, Jan Karski was a Polish freedom fighter and so much more. He was the eyes and ears of history, reporting on atrocities against the Jews in a variety of locations. It's almost an unbelievable story, except it's all true.
Yeah, remarkable story. The escape scenes alone are harrowing. And it calls upon David Lundy to portray a huge variety of characters with a large number of accents and all kinds of physicality. And yet, it is still an understated performance. The audience sits in rapt attention, and it has a tremendous, I think, dignity about it as we're hearing this very serious and yet mesmerizing story.
Well, I'm glad you said mesmerizing, because that's something I noticed. For 90 minutes, we drop in on vignette and scene and situation, one after the other. And yet, each segue felt so natural, so perfect, as, yes, that's exactly what I want to hear now. It's quite a performance. It's quite a play.
Indeed. And that's up at the Jewish Repertory Theater. Well, and then, for a complete and total change of pace, we headed on downtown to Second Generation Theater for their production of the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, a musical.
It's been around for years. High schools love to put it on, regional theaters, community theaters. And here we have a professional organization putting it on. And what a hoot.
It really is. William Finn, he also wrote Falsettos, this very clever score developed from a play that was originally improvised. And one of the original performers is credited for additional material, which really amounts to a lot of those clever definitions.
Right.
Using the word in a sentence. But it is a group of middle school children, then four volunteers from the audience, at least during Act One. They are all deftly eliminated through various amusing means before it comes down to the final two. And of course, each of these children has life crises of their own. Well, as do the adults, by the way, but except for Miss Peretti. She seems quite perfect, doesn't she?
She does. Amy Jekyll, who just has an amazing ability, a very mobile face. She can look with disdain one second and just be the perfect supporting mother type the next.
I love the bits where she gets on the microphone and reveals something horribly personal and totally awkward about someone, and just volunteering that the comfort counselor is doing his community service as a condition of his parole, and the medical condition of one of the children. Just
right.
It's all very, very funny. And then Steve Copps as vice principal, they'll never let me be the principal.
Because of the incident 5 years ago.
Yes, he's in a better place now. And he has to do a lot of the improvising, interacting with the spellers, particularly the volunteer spellers.
A quick appeal to folks who enjoy listening to this show. When you go to the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, please, if you're not an actor, go to the table and sign up to be one of the four guest spellers, because that's what we really want to see up there, is four community members. I believe the night you went, there were some professional actors. Same on the night I went.
Almost all. Well, of course, they volunteer. They wanted to be in the show. And you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm not saying it wouldn't be funny, but it is much funnier with civilians. And I think that when you're a professional performer, whether you mean to or not, you get into that space, you get hit by the light, you're there with your peers, and you feel compelled to perform. It can be funny. A politician would be funny. But the night I was there, these guys even picked up the choreography after the first verse. And I thought, okay, where are the real people? I particularly would like to praise Darian Brown, who plays Mr. Barfay, rhymes with parfait. good heavens, what a wonderful performance. The physicality, the vocalizations, the haughty attitude, just perfection. I thought he was sublime. He's the one with the magic foot. He spells the words with his foot on the floor before pronouncing them to avoid making a mistake.
And he doesn't. And whenever he's told that his spelling was correct, he just says with disdain, I know.
That is correct. I know.
Such fun. Well, it's a very busy week. I encourage folks to go to the podcast, go to the website. We'll have the full listings there of everything that's opened or is about to open.
For Theater Talk on WBFO,
I'm Peter Hall.
And I'm Anthony Chase.
Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief Podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.